Chapter 30. Note: stand straight and tall. Check. Done and done. Note: maintain the dignity of the white. Scratch that. That was probably a lost cause, considering she just kicked a man in the head in front of tens of thousands of people. Note: speak loudly and clearly. Don't talk fast, because you're nervous. Caris took a deep breath. Say this for executing a man, it does rather overshadow one's fear of public speaking. She looked out over the many thousands of faces staring at her and the charred corpse of High Luxiat Torleb and the huddled young Luxiat Quentin at her feet. She had moved out from under the shadow of Torleb's corpse. She had fought enough to know that even a roasted body can drip fluids, not something she wanted to wear. But coincidentally, her move had arrayed her so that she stood in the centre as judge, and the dead man hung to her left, and now to her right huddled the repentant young Luxiat Quentin. It wasn't an arrangement she had planned. Gavin certainly would have thought of it, standing here like the sign of the three, but then he'd had a lot more practice with theatrics, and he was able to pull off symbolism effortlessly. Caris would simply have to muddle through and accept luck when it came knocking. "Luxiat Quentin Nahid," she said loudly. "You have earned expulsion from the magisterium for the violation of your vows. You deserve to be stripped of your title." He said nothing. He was already on his knees, and he simply slumped forward, silent. "Quentin Nahid, you have earned being disowned by your family for the shame you have brought upon them. You deserve to be stripped of your name. Quentin, you have earned exile from your satrapy for dishonouring the gift of your education. You deserve to be stripped of a home. And most of all, convict, you have earned death for the murder of Lucia Agnelli. You deserve to be stripped of your life." Two blackguards came forward and lifted Quentin to his feet. He wasn't weeping, nor did he have the 10-league stare of the doomed. He was staring toward Tyr, who had pulled off her eye caps and was meeting his eyes with a resolute, calm strength Caris hadn't known the young woman had. Almost too quietly for Caris to hear, Quentin was repeatedly whispering a breath prayer. "Or Harlem, give me strength for the path you've laid before me." They took his arms, and as he stepped into place, offering no resistance, he stepped on the foot of one of the blackguards. "Pardon me, sir, I did not mean to do that," he said. "Hold," Caris commanded. She turned her gaze to the crowd, that restive, hungry hound eyeing her hands for its next treat. She glanced at Quentin, but his eyes were down. To the crowd she announced, "We are called to do justice, but to love mercy. How do we do those things on any day? How do we do those things in war? We have not Orhulam's perfect sight. The traitor we spare today may return to the fight and kill our allies tomorrow. But even a traitor may repent truly. And today I have seen a vast gulf between the attitudes of these two men doomed to die. Thus, today I will extend the hardest mercy I know. Quentin, you will not die for your crimes." The young man stared at her as if she were speaking a foreign tongue. "We are at war," Caris said, "and I will not cast aside a weapon that can be used. Quentin, your sin was pride, a pride carefully banked in hot coals and a false humility. The body can die but once. Pride can die every day. You, Quentin, shall live a slave. You shall be my slave until you learn what true humility is. I expect it may take all the years of your life. And why my slave? Because you are to be a lash for me. We are called to do justice and to love mercy. So I will extend the mercy of your life to you. But we are also called to walk humbly in the light, and this is the lesson that too many of us have forgotten, a lesson that the Chromeria has ignored. You, Quentin, will not be ignored. Despite what you deserve, you will not be expelled from the Magisterium. You shall be a Luxiat still. You will be a badge of their shame for failing Orhulam, for allowing darkness to enter the Temple of Light. You will be dressed in gold, to remind them how easy it is to love gold and to be led astray by a love for earthly pleasures. You will be assigned to study beside and tutor Luxiats, to turn your brilliant mind to helping them in their work and to helping us win this war. You will be Orholm's justice to them. You shall be a lash against their pride, and the High Luxiats and I shall continue to talk about whether this is punishment enough to cleanse the stain they have allowed into the House of Light. Before Caris had climbed up onto the platform, Andros Guile had reminded her that this was no amphitheatre. Whatever tricks they did to project her voice, those at the back wouldn't hear a word she said. Naturally, her words were being transcribed and would be published all around the Seven Satrapies, but what could be seen should be considered separately from what could be heard. If she wasn't careful, Caris would be seen doing nothing to a traitor. That would look like weakness. So Quentin's enslavement had to be seen. So Caris now walked over to the seated High Luxiat Amazal. She pulled out a large ceremonial dagger and handed it to him. "If you'll do the honours of clipping his ear, High Luxiat," she asked.
"I prefer we handle such discipline privately," he said.
"Oh, I know what you prefer," Caris said. "Aurea Pallard trusted you to handle your own affairs faithfully, and you rewarded her trust by raising at least one traitor to the High Magisterium itself. You have loved the darkness of your privacy. Now we banish darkness from the House of Light." He held her eye, jaw clenching.
"Don't be a fool," Andros said to High Luxiat Amazal from his seat, pitching his voice low so no one beyond the platform would hear him. "Every moment you hesitate, you show the people that you are reluctant to give either justice or mercy or both. Accept the loss or change the game and fight."
High Luxiat Amazal flushed, but he took the knife. He took the steps toward the kneeling Quentin and held a hand up in the sign of the three, moving it through the four quadrants in the circle of blessing. But he wasn't praying. He said,
"You will pay for this."
He wasn't speaking to Quentin.
"Happily,"
Caris said, and she meant it. There was something refreshing about the kind of man who would tell you he was angry at you. Frontal attacks were so much easier to defend against. But something changed in his posture, and Caris's old blackguard senses began tingling.
"By the power vested in me, as High Luxiat," Amazal declared to the crowd.
"One moment, High Luxiat,"
a voice interjected. Andros Giles. Faster than she would have expected he could move, Andros was already standing beside the furious old man.
"Let us show that we are united in this. The Promarchos together with the White and the Luxiats, against the pagans and traitors. I will hold the boy."
Andros put his hands on Quentin's shoulders, but then whispered to Amazal,
"You have to move faster than that if you wish to change the game. Too late now."
Too late for what? For a moment, Caris didn't understand. Then she did. The old man had intended to say Quentin had gone too far. He had intended to kill him, to assert magisterial privilege over its own, despite whatever the White wanted. He had intended not to have the constant embarrassment of Caris's slaves being around, humiliating his Luxiats. And Andros Guile had figured it out before perhaps even the old man had. Certainly Caris would have been too late. The vein in Amazal's forehead throbbed.
"And if I swear to God I'll put you up on the glare next," Andros said.
Amazal looked like a bully punched between the eyes, disbelieving. But then he saw the look in Andros's eyes and believed. The rage went out of the old High Luxiat in a whoosh. He spoke loudly again.
"By the power vested in me, by the power vested in me, here is the Chromeria's justice and mercy, Luxiat Quentin Nahid. You are hereby enslaved."
He sliced Quentin's ear, blood spitting out onto the High Luxiat's hands and his lambent white robes. Amazal was not a bad man, nor a bad Luxiat. But he was a bad leader, and that made him a bad High Luxiat. He looked perfectly the part, with flowing white beard, dignified disposition, speaker's voice, and gracious manners. He cared for others deeply and offered mercy wherever he went. But mercy ceases to be a virtue when it enables further injustice. The tower guards dragged Quentin away, and Caris ghosted through the next speech, barely aware, condemning the traitor prophet to death on the glare for fomenting rebellion, placing spies,
and blasphemy. Veronique was the man who'd been confirmed to be a spy handler by the Mighty in one of their training missions. Caris had gotten a spy close to him through that operation, and just before she passed away, Aurea Pilar had had her people scoop up the lot of them. Of them, only this man was a drafter. He was a sub-bred, but he'd not been Chromaria educated, so he was probably little danger, but despite that he was kept in the special garb for condemned drafters, which was woven with hellstones to disrupt any Luxin he tried to gather. He was also blindfolded to forbid him light, and subjected to a litany's worth of other traditions that Caris didn't even know about, much less comprehend the reasons for. But despite the strangeness of the black garb and blindfold, it was only as they lifted Veronique onto the mirror that Caris snapped back into focus on the moment. She'd never seen a drafter executed on the glare. It was supposed to be the worst way for a drafter to die, or the two worst ways, really, depending on whether you decided to draft or not. She'd heard it described as choosing whether to die of constipation or diarrhea. On the other hand, how could it be worse than burning to death? They moved into place, and Caris donned dark spectacles as he was lifted high. Again the people's mirrors came out, and Sada Superviolet came forward. Again it was only as Sada swung the mirrors into focus that a blade sliced the blindfold from the condemned's face. Though Caris was prepared for it this time, it was still like standing in a thunderstorm of light. It was like going from the snowy slopes of Atan's Teeth to the hottest desert on the cracked lands in an instant. The heat alone was a hammer. The light itself had a physical presence, a thickness, a reality so heavy that it made all the material universe seem like a ghostly realm in comparison. A concussive force pressed out Caris's breath. She wanted to drop to her knees. She wanted to hide. In that moment, Caris believed those who swore that Orholam himself was within that beam of light, and she prayed only that he turn not his eye upon her. The black drop cloth hiding the accused had already caught fire. The cloth was both symbolic and practical, intending to represent sin and attempting to hide from Orholam's eye, and intended as a mercy to keep the people's mirrors from burning the condemned and torturing him before all the mirrors could come into place. Orholam's glare was excruciating, but it was brief. All the light in the world illumined the traitor, and he screamed. His soul screamed a name. But it was impossible to catch the disembodied syllables over the flame and the pain. The air above Veronique undulated as he let out a huge wave of sub-red, a beam into the sky. Unable to form Luxin anywhere else because of the hellstone clothing pressing in on his skin, he tried to shed the excess heat from his face. It was too much to handle, too much to draft artfully. It was a gush. It was also why the condemned's face on Orholam's glare was angled skyward, so he couldn't attack the crowd around him. The geyser of heat crackled and cracked like a flag in the wind, even flickering into flames, and it kept going. As did Veronique's howl, a lone, long ululation of agony as skin burnt and cartilage burnt and bone burst forth, blackening. Then they stopped altogether, drafting and screaming both, cut off with a name.
Nabiros, the prophet said.
A soft, life-sloughing sigh. A summons. For one heartbeat, nothing happened. It was long enough that Caris realized Veronique's body wasn't burning. And then his skin burst apart in a spray of gore, his head tearing apart as his neck vomited out three dog's heads, black and red, growling and snapping. His shoulders bulged and muscles knotted in his skinny legs, splitting the skin like a bursting boil. But his limbs stayed bound, and in the next heartbeat he sagged, deflated, defeated, and died. The dog's heads sizzled in Orholam's obliterating light, and his whole body burnt like any man's, at least that of any man with three blackened dog skulls attached to three necks. For Caris, the moment stretched like a raindrop about to fall off a leaf, bulging, heavy with intent. No one even breathed. The civilians had ducked back, cowering, and for this precious instant they still disbelieved. The blackguards had weapons drawn, as did Caris herself, all unknowing, her other hand out to them, signalling no. A collective gasp passed over the crowd in the next moment. It was disbelief, literal incredulity. Did I actually see that? Did you see that?
but it was undeniable. The skeletal remains had three heads. And then the collective question. What the hell was that? What the hell is that? Karis gave a signal, and finally the mirrors turned away. When the light faded, there reigned a baffled quiet. The audience held mirrors in nerveless fingers, forgetting to turn them away. Still no one spoke. And then children started weeping, and not only children, but men and women too. Karis had always been fast. Not being big or strong, she'd taken to heart early the lesson her trainer had given. It's often not who hits hardest who wins, but who hits first. So she ignored the terror raging in her own stomach, the knee-weakening, bile-churning confusion.
"Orholam be praised!"
she shouted, throwing her hands over her head. "Don't look shaken. Look triumphant."
"Orholam invictus,"
Andros Gyle said quietly behind her. Of course, he was the next fastest to move. Even he hadn't expected this.
"Orholam invictus!" Karis shouted.
"Orholam the invincible, the unconquered."
"Orholam invictus!" the crowd roared.
What they'd seen wasn't a monster, Karis proclaimed. What they'd seen was a monster vanquished by Orholam's light. The crowd roared as Karis had never heard before, and the crisis was averted. And though nothing she had done had been intended to aggrandize herself, she saw the truth of what Aurea Paloa had once told her. A small woman standing next to a great light casts a long shadow. From that day forth, the people no longer referred to Karis as Karis Whiteoak or Karis Gyle, and only rarely as Karis White. She wasn't the new White, or the Blackguard's White, or Gavin Gyle's widow, or the girl who had caused the False Prism's War. The people loved her. They called her the Iron White.